60 seconds of the business. Go.
Thank you to our Patreon supporters. We are thrilled to have a Patreon, and we are thrilled that people are signing up for it. Alicia, you have names, I think, of those who
have
joined our little community
of our special Patreon peeps.
Mm-hmm.
Nikki, Lisa, Jenny, Heather, Aaron, Carol, Amy M, Amy B, Kayla, Sydney, y'all rock.
Thank you
so much for supporting what we're doing. I hope that you are digging our weird behind the scene random musing chit chat.
Yep.
Other listeners, consider joining us there. You can get in for as little as $2 a month and get some pretty hilarious bonus content.
We think we're very funny. We think we're hilarious.
We think we're hilarious.
That's patreon.com/trashydivorces.
You ready to do this?
On to the show.
Let's go to the show.
Welcome to Trashy Divorces, week 10.
Episode 10.
Episode 10.
10 trash cans for this week's stories.
Yeah. Who do you have for us this week, Alicia?
This week I'm bringing to you rock and roll's trashiest love triangle. George Harrison, Patty Boyd, Eric Clapton.
Yikes.
So good. It's an amazing, it really is an amazing story. With a big shout out to all of our friends over across the pond. I think you'll find this one pretty fun and deep in exploration of your English musical legacy.
For sure.
So it was a lot of fun. It's a little bit more fun than yours.
Yeah, mine.
What you got this week?
Mine is American musical royalty. You know, people who helped birth rock and roll into the world.
Yeah.
Rhythm and blues into the world. But it's Ike and Tina Turner. And while I knew that there was violence in their marriage, there was so much more violence in their marriage than I knew. So this one's a little tough.
If domestic violence is something that you are sensitive to, you may want to instead, Stacey, you have an alternative idea.
I do. We are going to jam-pack our website, trashydivorces.com, with video clips from both of our stories. So we're going to have Beatles. We're going to have Eric Clapton. We're going to, like, Layla's going to be there. We're going to have Ike and Tina Turner. We're going to have
everything.
Proud Mary.
It's a great concert lineup.
It's just, and it's also people who've covered them. Mick Jagger will be on our website, not through his doing, but YouTube is a great thing. Beyonce, you name it. Probably if you are trapped in an office this week, I know a good way for you to kill a few hours with some great music.
With some great tunes.
So it is. Mm-hmm. It's a great story, right?
It's like, a great story.
Tina Turner is amazing. One of my heroes. She is just phenomenally great. But getting there was tough.
So yeah, just as a word of warning, like, it was hard for you to tell.
Yeah.
It was difficult to hear. The story ends up on a really positive note
because sure.
Tina Turner is a badass.
Totes.
But if you're sensitive to that, just a cautionary warning use some self-care.
Yeah.
What we're presenting this week, rock and roll.
Rock
Trashy Divorces.
And roll. Yeah, and seriously, visit our website for so much music. All that we can fit is going to be there. It will be a wonderful way to kill a work day this week. Or any week.
You ready to take the garbage out?
Let's do it.
Ah, and it starts.
And it begins. Alicia, you have a different kind of royalty this week, don't you?
God, rock and roll royalty.
Anyone I've heard of?
Perhaps you've heard of a few friends in this tale.
I see.
You ready? This is good. I am excited about this.
Like, prefacing this. Let's set expectations. This is good.
This is good. I really went down some amazing rabbit holes and will have to admit clearly that I have held the White Album in hostile territory in my heart for a long time. Because I read Helter Skelter at a very young age, and there's such a connection.
Okay.
I've put off the White. The Beatles are amazing.
Sure.
Yes.
100%. That is not a controversial opinion.
100%, yeah. Yes. But I really have been, I got to reacquaint myself with the White Album in this research, and I'm loving all of it, and welcome to my trashy love triangle.
Ooh.
Of George Harrison, Patty Boyd, and Eric Clapton.
Wow.
What?
You've been talking about this one since we started germinating the idea for this podcast.
This is the trashiest love triangle in rock and roll history.
Cool.
It's such a good story.
All right. Tell me.
There is love.
I know basically nothing about it except that you've been like, oh, there's a trashy.
You're sitting down.
I am. I'm sitting down.
Okay. Relax. Right. Settle in. There is love, I suppose. But this story is way more about infatuation and obsession. And just wowzers. Some women are loved and adored by legit, verifiable musicians. It's a job that people have. Right?
I mean, I'm told.
Some women are loved and adored by, like, a genuine rock legend. Rock and roll superstar music people have.
Sure.
This lady was loved and adored by two verifiable rock superstars. Trashy love triangle. Of this particular lady who was loved and adored both by George Harrison and Eric Clapton, and her name is Patti Boyd.
Okay.
In 2007, Rolling Stone referred to Patti as a legendary rock muse for her role in inspiring the music of both Harrison and Clapton. Roger Cormier of Mental Floss similarly recognizes her as one of the most important muses in rock and roll history.
Mm.
Why is that? In addition to Layla, she was also the inspiration for Wonderful Tonight and Bell Bottom Blues and George Harrison's Something, which is my mother's favorite song. So, hey, Mom, if you're listening.
I would like to give...
And to all the moms out there.
On the topic of muse, I would like to encourage you to listen to What's Her Name podcast. Carolyn Cassidy?
Yeah.
Because I was about to say Neil Cassidy's wife.
I haven't read it yet.
But they talk about how like the muse designation is really just, it's just really like an anti-feminist designation.
Muse is great. I think muse removes you a little from yourself, which will end up coming back around to at the end of the story. But Patti was certainly an inspiration. Patricia Ann Boyd.
Yes.
Born on St. Patrick's Day in 1944.
Heroine of our story?
Heroine of our story.
Maybe. I don't know.
Is a St. Patrick's Day baby.
Okay.
Born in Somerset. Siblings come along. Their family moves to Scotland, then Surrey, then Kenya, then Nairobi.
Okay.
Her father is a Royal Air Force pilot.
Oh, okay. I was going to be like diplomat. Okay, but yeah.
You're a military kid. You get it, right?
Yep.
Family moves a lot. After dad is discharged, the Boyds move back to England, where more half-brothers and half-sisters come into Patty's life. So she's the oldest kid of a military family. She gets 3 GCEO level passes in 1961 and hotfoots it out of there in 1962 to the swinging scene in London, baby.
Yep.
Okay. So she gets a job. She's a shampoo girl at Elizabeth Arden.
Okay.
Her London salon. Red Door, Elizabeth Arden's fancy big deal. And one of the clients who goes there works for Honey Magazine and says to Patti, like, you're pretty cute. You should work as a model. So Patti's like, all right, well, let me try that.
Yeah, that sounds pretty good.
She models in London, then Paris. She kind of becomes the it girl. She's in Vogue, Vanity Fair, Elle, Honey, newspapers.
Wow.
She's photographed by like every top fashion photographer in the business. And this era in the early 60s is the explosion of this industry.
Right.
And she becomes the base that all other later models like Twiggy base their look on. She becomes an international celebrity, is the embodiment of the British female look. So mini skirt, long straight hair, and wide-eyed loveliness, as noted by journalist Tom Hibbert. She becomes a muse to designer Aussie Clark. Shampoo girdle model, right? Up and coming. In 1964, she appears in an advertisement campaign. You're welcome, England. For Smith's Crisps, which I thought sounded like kind of like a cookie, but no, those are biscuits.
Mm-hmm.
These are a potato chip with the skin left on when it's fried. So like it's like a heavier, stockier chip, and they sound delicious.
Mm-hmm.
So she goes to this commercial. It's directed by Richard Lester, whose next project just happens to be a little film featuring this up-and-coming British band called The Beatles. Have you heard of them?
I mean... Well, let me ask you this. Mm-hmm. When was the British invasion? Like, would I have heard of them in 1964 as an American?
It is about to, all hell's about to break loose.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, all right. So we're right at that edge.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
So Richard Lester tells 20-year-old Patty, hey, March 2nd, go down to Paddington Station. I have a part for you to play. He's directing A Hard Day's Night that day. So she heads on down, and she has one line in the movie, prisoners, and she happens to meet the quiet and shy 21-year-old George Harrison. She's a little shy, he's a little shy, but not so much around her because, hold on, trashy tidbit, because that's what I do. George Harrison's birthday is February 25th. He's a Pisces too. Whoa, two fish swimming in the same. Two water signs, two Pisces. A quick summary. I know you're laughing, but this is what I do. Two Pisces partners will have trouble trusting each other. Their changeable natures will shift their relationship all the time. And only if they share enough love, they might be able to handle the changes and stay together. In most cases, they will not fall in love because of their inner need to inspire their partner and help them grow. They don't need this from each other because they already inspire themselves. Two fish on their own. The demise takes a little while. We're going to start with happy times.
Okay, sure, sure.
Just a little background.
Well, I mean, you can't get divorced if you don't get married.
You know, I'm going to do the astrological profile. If it's interesting of couples, like, it's kind of fascinating to me.
Okay. And to many. Not to me, but to, I know a lot of people really are into that. That's why horoscopes appear everywhere, so.
Double Pisces, yeah.
Okay.
Code name, double Pisces. So on the set, George sits next to Patty at lunch, and he is enthralled. He proposes to her that day. Will you marry me?
The day they meet.
Like at lunch, yeah. Will you marry me?
Okay.
And Patty's like, I got a boyfriend, dude.
Can you pass the salad dressing? Also, right. Would you marry me? Okay.
Well, and he's like, all right, if you don't marry me, will you go out with me? And she's like, man, I got a boy.
And he's like, I'm a Beatle, bitch.
No, he doesn't. You know, she kind of plays it off, but she goes home that night and like talks with one of her friends who's like, are you fucking crazy? George Harrison is a Beatle. You say yes. You say yes, you idiot. You need to dump your boyfriend
right.
immediately.
And go with the Beatle, yeah.
So Patty does, and she goes with George on their first date, accompanied by Brian Epstein, the Beatles' manager, to a private gentleman's club called the Garrett Club. They see each other as much as they're able. He's on tour, but in July 1964, he buys a home called Kinfonz in Esher, Surrey, out of London. It's like a quieter place to chill. Patty soon moves in with them.
Mm.
So swinging mod London is loving this. The shy Beatle and the cover girl, they are beautiful. They're hot on the scene. Her modeling career is skyrocketing. She's in more covers and commercials. She is described by UK underground writer Barry Miles as by far the most glamorous of the Beatles' wives and girlfriends.
Ooh.
George is just captivated, and he gets George Epstein's permission to marry Patty. He's like, okay. So the couple gets engaged on December 25th, 1965. They marry January 21st, 1966. They settle kind of into cozy domesticity. They mod London out. Everything's pretty great. He's a Beatle. George is away a lot. He's touring. There's practice. He's hanging with his buds, John, Paul, and Ringo. Kinfonz, the house that they're in, is the house that they all kind of hang out the most frequently. It's close to John and Ringo's homes in St. George Hill. Like, they're this musical set of brothers and are literally changing the world of music every day. The bond is strong. Patty later tells Beatles biographer Honey Davies, Hunter Davies, not Honey Davies.
I was thinking,
but hey,
Honey is,
I like that
comes
guy.
Up a lot in this story. Okay.
That the four Beatles had a bond that neither she nor any other wife could penetrate. But Patty stays busy. She writes a column for 16 magazine called Patty's Letter from London and reports on beauty tips and tricks and the fashion trends in Carnaby Street and what the Beatles and the Rolling Stones were wearing. Beatles, female Beatles fans are sort of targeting her. You took George away.
Yeah, I'm not surprised to hear this. Right. I mean, if there had been social media at the time, like, can you imagine?
She's the bad guy.
Yeah.
You stole George. George is my favorite Beatle. So George is like, hey, quit your job. Quit modeling. Like, just let's come live behind our 15-foot gate and don't get yourself targeted. In July of 1968, Patty and her sister Jenny, who is also a model, open a boutique in London called Jennifer Juniper from the Donovan song, who actually wrote the song for Jenny. Did I mention Donovan is their friend too? And wait for it, Jenny is pretty close to marrying Mick Fleetwood in another less than 2 years.
Okay.
Like, this story is musically lit.
Yeah.
Jenny manages Jennifer Juniper, which is a shop that sells antiques and other objets d'art. Patty is a buyer, so she can kind of get out of the... Okay. That just sets the stage to let you know what she's doing professionally.
Okay.
Because she's more than just a muse. She actually is doing some things.
Right.
But now we're going to take a step back. They get married in January 66.
Sure.
George is on tour. In September and October of 1966, the Beatles' final concert tour ends. Boyd and Harrison are kind of able to have a little honeymoon where they go to Bombay, India, as guests of Indian classical musician Ravi Shankar.
Mm-hmm.
And they begin to get really into yoga and vegetarianism and Eastern mysticism, and it's pretty cool. Patty becomes a member of the Spiritual Regeneration Movement the following February, and Patty hears that the Maharishi...
Sure. Spiritual leader, basically.
Spiritual leader.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
Giving a series of talks at the London Hilton.
Oh, okay.
And Patty persuades George to come along. So on August 24th, they go as a couple with John Lennon, Paul McCartney, and Jane Asher. They're all in the front row listening to the Maharishi.
Maharishi. Something, shit. Yeah.
Speak.
Email us the correct pronunciation, people.
Seriously,
we appreciate
I'm so
it.
Sorry. Ringo does not attend. His wife, Maureen, just delivered their son 5 days earlier. After this particular event, the Beatles were granted a 90-minute private audience with the Maharishi.
Yeah, that dude.
Yes. He impresses them with his philosophy. More like, hey, they can get my message out. The next day,
I was gonna say,
they travel to Bangor, North Wales, to attend another seminar. They leave London's Euston Station on August 25th. All four Beatles are on it, along with Mick Jagger, Marianne Faithfull, and Donovan. John Lennon's wife, Cynthia, actually missed the train. She was mistaken for a fan and held back by a security guard, and that sort of marks the end of their marriage.
Really?
Like, that was sort of a dividing point, because now they're about to go, hold on, all shit's about to break loose. So the Beatles spend 2 nights in Bangor. Due to a last-minute decision to attend, they slept in a rented schoolroom. They get their personal mantras. The Beatles' encounter with the Maharishi, yeah, coincided with their realization that LSD didn't hold the answers they were looking for. swear to God, all this is happening.
Well, I mean, yeah.
They're like, hey, guys, we... tried drugs for a long time, and meditation's better. Like, this is a better way to achieve the enlightenment that we're looking for. They hold a press conference to reveal their new passion for meditation and announce they've given up drugs. This is August 25th, 26th. The Beatles manager, Brian Epstein, was supposed to join them in Bangor after the August bank holiday. However, he died of an overdose of barbiturates mixed with alcohol on the 27th of August.
Oh, my God. So, like, as they are having this experience.
Period of enlightenment, their mentor, business manager, the guy who's sort of led them through the arc of what's been happening, is dead. So, everything sort of falls apart. Now they have to become businessmen. Like, this is how you get Apple. This is how, like,
right.
They have to figure out how the fuck to do this, but they are all in.
But they're all artists, and that can be tricky.
It can be tricky. So, they're figuring out how to be businessmen. They travel to India in February of 1968 to take part in a meditation course. So, you get George, you get Patty, you get her sister Jenny, John and Cynthia Lennon, Paul McCartney, his longtime girlfriend Jane Asher, Ringo Starr, his wife Maureen, Donovan, Mike Love, Mia Farrow, her sister Prudence, who Dear Prudence is written about. So John and Paul are meditating and inspired. They're writing a shit ton of a lot of the White Album. And George gets kind of pissy, like, you guys are missing the point, but it all goes to shit. I think the seeds of the Beatles' breakup is really grown in this particular time period. These are broken up within 2 years, but I think this is where the seeds of it comes in. Like, George is in a cult, and he grows more distant from Patty. They are all there hanging out at the ashram. Ringo Starr is the first to leave. He says the food is rotten. He's getting out of there.
Good for him.
McCartney leaves shortly afterward. He only, like, intends to stay for a little bit. Lennon and Harrison are still there. And a story sweeps the camp that the Maharashi had made a pass at Mia Farrow or her sister. Like, it's all bad. There's a really good story that John Lennon tells Jan Winter in Rolling Stone about how he and George talked about it. Like, John Lennon pretty much went down to his super rich ass decked out bungalow and was like, dude, what the hell? And called him on his bluff. John splits. He's out the door. George goes with him. They're out of there. But there's the White Album. So, yay. That's pretty cool.
Okay.
McCartney and Harrison in particular remain believers in this. Everybody heads back to England. And George gets a new mate. A new friend. Eric Clapton. Heard of him?
Was he at the retreat?
No.
Okay.
They're just, like, they're in the music scene together.
Okay, so they just meet and back in merry old England. Okay.
Well, and so by this time, Eric has been with the Yardbirds, Cream, Derek and the Dominoes. Sure. He's so part of the London scene.
Sure.
He gets along with all the Beatles and most especially George, his mate, because he has something really special. And her name is Patty. Okay. You ready?
Yeah.
Enter Eric. March 30th. He's an Aries. Fire sign. Way different than a water sign. Do you want to laugh a little louder? Because I know that you're going to enjoy this.
Okay, no, continue.
Okay, fire and water signs.
All right, so getting some boiling happening.
No, actually, fire and water...
like, makes steam.
Does make steam, but water also douses fire out. So it's a delicate balance with a fire sign and a water sign.
Sure.
So, they are both driven more by emotion than logic, meaning when they're going to make a decision, they'll often go with their heart rather than their head. Not that they don't use logic, it's just not what wins. When in equilibrium, the interaction will be a soothing warm of a hot tub. But if the thermostat goes out, you're done. Like, it's okay. But Eric Clapton,
yeah,
really likes Patty.
Yeah.
He starts showing up.
Also, he's a great guitar player, aside from being so good. A March baby.
I know you think I'm silly. Okay. Eric is twitterpated about Patty immediately, but George is his BFF, right?
Sure.
So in an effort to satisfy his infatuation, he decides he'll just date Patty's sister Paula.
Oh, that never works.
Yeah, that dear listener.
Yeah, right.
That
yeah.
did not work.
Did not work.
And George is kind of openly flirtatious with other women, and he meditates for a lot of the hours every day, and Patty's kind of alone, and Eric Clapton is adoring. Like, there are little puppy swoon heart symbols in his eyes. He is crazy pant kittens
sure
over her.
Okay.
So one day she gets a secret love note in the mail about just, you're the best person ever and I love you so much. And it's signed just E. And she brings it to George. She's like, I got a secret admirer. What the hell is this? Funny. He calls her that night. Did you get my note?
Oh, no.
Check box. Yes, no. Right? Like,
oh, my God.
Oh, but wait. Now it starts. Because George is sort of emotionally unavailable when they start spending a lot of time together. And she says he's outrageous. And he's crazy pants over her.
Sure.
So they begin an emotional affair.
Okay.
He woos her. He's showing her attention. Her husband is like,
right.
I don't think anything really happened, but she is definitely walking on the wild side of that. I'm a married woman, but definitely involved in something that is probably not congruent with my marital vows.
Right. And my beetle is letting me down.
I mean, true that. So one day.
What happens one day?
Oh, God. Eric Clapton is like, hey, why don't you come on over to my apartment? I have something I want to show you. I mean, that's
what do you
bad.
Think? What no. do you think you wanted to show?
He pops in. No, he pops in the.
It's in my pants. Come on over. I need to show you something. Okay, good.
Well, there's something. There's something I want you to hear.
Oh,
sorry.
That's different. Okay.
Pops in a cassette. Layla comes on.
Literally one of the greatest songs that's ever been composed. It is. There's just...
Clapton drew inspiration from the story of Layla and Majnun by Persian writer Nizami, casting himself as the poet driven to madness by his unattainable love. Layla bowls her over.
As it did the world.
But she's like, oh, Jesus Christ, this is about me, and panic sets in. Like, she's like, I got to get out of here.
Right. Because I don't want to see the thing in your pants. I'm married.
Exactly. Yeah. I gots to go.
Yeah.
So that evening, there's a party, and Patty and Eric are in the garden. And George wasn't going to go, and then he ended up showing up. So, like, George comes on out in the garden, sees Patty and Eric, and, you know, having a conversation or something. And George comes up, and he's like, hey, what's going on, guys? And Eric says to George Harrison, I'm in love with your wife.
Whoa. Wow. Bold.
Bold. Super bold.
I've just written Layla, you see, and
I'm feeling good
pretty stoked about my future.
George is rightly furious and says to Patty, like, go with him if you want. Patty says she just wants the earth to swallow her.
I'm sure.
Now you've got two fish, and she's pushed into making a decision. And she's like, no, I'm going with you, George. Like, come on. The last time she sees Eric, he has a bottle of heroin and threatens to take it all if she doesn't run off with him. So, yeah, way to go, dude. She does not. She stays in her marriage, and Eric proceeds to sink into a fairly significant heroin addiction.
Wow.
For the next 3 to 4 years.
Okay, and let's be clear. My guess is he'd already used heroin plenty of times.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So, like, it would be incorrect to say that Patty Boyd somehow caused him to start using heroin.
Well, I don't know. I don't know how much of a user he was. He did.
I'm just saying.
End of the story, he does get treatment for addiction.
Good.
Not sure how much he was using, but he really goes into a self-imposed heroin exile for 3 to 4 years in his fucking underground.
Sure. Not her responsibility. Responsibility.
No.
Okay.
Fuck no.
Just wanted to put that out there.
But his unrequited love leads him to make some unfortunate choices.
It can make you crazy, yeah. For sure.
So in March 1970... a month before the Beatles' breakup, Patty and George moved to Friar Park, which is a Victorian neo-Gothic mansion in Henley-on-Thames. By this point, George is devoted to Indian spirituality and the Hare Krishna movement. They're unsuccessful in starting a family. Oh. George won't consider adoption.
Hmm. Oh, she's really not getting any of her needs met at this point.
Okay. No needs met. Patty resumes her modeling career sort of in rebellion. The Beatles break up. Unhappy. God. Drugs.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Just drugs, drinking. Everybody's unhappy. Patty would stay for 3 more years. But George cheats a lot.
Oh.
So it ends up that he is having a pretty significant affair with the wife of Ringo Starr, Maureen.
Holy shit. Patty, wow. How did the Beatles stay together as long as they did? That's the real question, right?
Patty says that, you know, she was the last person I would have expected to stab me in the back. George says he, like, it is all bad. Patty starts an affair with Faces guitarist Ronnie Wood. Patty's done. Like, George's repeated infidelities were getting her really close, and Patty says Maureen was the final straw. I'm out of here.
Right.
Re-enter, cleaned up, off heroin, Eric Clapton. He has had a bad time of it. He's been deep in addiction since Patty firmly rebuffed him in late 1970. His musical brother, who he really was partnering with, Duane Allman, was killed in 1971. So he hits it pretty rough. He kind of turns it around in 73, beats heroin, which is great, but replaces it with alcohol. So well, not
less
so great.
Yeah.
In the summer of 74, Patty leaves George and shimmies on over to see what she has been thinking about for the last 4 years with Eric Clapton.
Sure.
Fire sign. Okay. Things are good. They're booze soaked, but they're good. He writes Wonderful Tonight. They continue to date while George and Patty's divorce is working through its paces. It is finalized on the 9th of June, 1977. Here's what I think you will appreciate. Patty's solicitor?
Lawyer, yeah.
Patty Grafton Green of the London firm Theodore Goddard later remarked on the sensitivity shown by each party toward the other, which he found particularly rare in his experience of high-stakes divorces. He said, there was no overreacting, no greed, or playing with each other's emotions. I wish all divorces were so well handled.
Nice. So they had a non-trashy divorce.
I didn't, but yay for y'all. Trashy divorces, gold star.
Yeah, gold star, yeah.
Woohoo, you guys get a cake. Seriously, like it
George
was...
Harrison is dead, right?
Yeah.
So we cannot send him a cake.
No, well... You were in the hall of non-trashy divorce for trashy divorces.
Sure.
It was kind of nice. Like, it was just well handled.
But I feel like there's more coming. I mean, is she Eric Clapton's wife now?
Yes. So Patty and Eric. No, not now.
Oh, not now. Okay.
No,
okay.
No.
I was like, wow, well, good on all of these people. That's amazing.
Oh, you really don't know the story, do you?
No, I really don't.
Okay, are you enthralled so far?
Tell me more.
Okay. So Patty and Eric marry in 1970.
Oh, okay. So they do marry.
They do marry. They marry in 79.
Okay.
It goes bad.
Oh, okay.
They remain friendly with George Harrison, who took to calling Eric Clapton his husband-in-law.
That's actually really great.
Yeah. No, they're all still friends, but they proceed through 14 tumultuous years of marriage.
Oh.
Eric is drinking 2 bottles of brandy a day.
Wow.
She's drinking 2. He later admits to being a full-blown alcoholic who is often violent to Patty.
No.
Patty leaves Eric in April of 1987, providing the following reasons.
He's a full-blown alcoholic who hits me?
Years of alcoholism, his domestic violence, his numerous affairs, and oh yes, 2 children with other women while they are married.
Oh my God. Wow, this actually dovetails so nicely with my story coming up. Okay, that sucks.
So that's where it sort of falls apart. Eric Clapton takes her to dinner and tells her that, hey, I'm about to have a child with, and he asks her to help raise him. And she's like, no. Whatever, that was the breaking point where that fish was going to swim in her own stream.
Sure.
She feels like if she made that choice to do that, she would lose herself.
Sure.
So at 43, she is legitimately alone. She has lost her identity. And she says that she really did give up her personal identity in both of those marriages. I think a la the muse, right?
Right.
You are inspiring to somebody else all the time. You haven't inspired yourself. In 1989, Patty's divorce is granted on the grounds of infidelity and unreasonable behavior. And that's with a U in
sure.
behavior, which
it's
I
a,
love.
It's a very British way to say domestic violence.
Patty subsequently suspects that Eric Clapton's pursuit of her when she was married to George had more to do with the competitive aspect between the two of them. She says Eric just wanted what George had. Eric Clapton, in later interviews, says that he was obsessed with her. He gets asked. There was a really good interview, and he gets asked, like, is she the love of your life? And he's like, was pretty much fucked up every day for 25 years. I can tell you I was obsessed with her. And he, you know, you can kind of see him look back now sober.
Right, right.
At how he is reckoning those motivations, sure. which is sort of interesting. Up to George's death, George and Eric remain friends. Eric Clapton does remarry, does have kids. So he seems to have pulled off, after gaining some sobriety, a happy, successful life.
Right.
Getting off the sauce. So another gold star there. Patty meets property developer Rod Weston in 1991, and they date from 91 until they get married in April 2015.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Patty's, wow. Yeah. So much dovetailing. So much.
So Patty says it's almost our silver anniversary, so we thought we'd better get on with it. So I can probably understand her hesitation.
Yeah, no doubt.
Well, and also, like,
let me test this out for a while. I don't know how deeply I want
to. So yeah. One of our friends that I'm going to call by the nickname J-Pop.
Okay.
And I talked about this because J-Pop read Patty Boyd's biography, Wonderful Tonight, which she wrote in 2007.
Okay.
J-Pop was like, I don't know. She kind of, you know, rode that. She certainly didn't stop taking advantage of them. And I'm like, hold up. You get divorced from two rock and roll legends and you were their muse for that long. I am going to ride that financial train for as long as it is worth. By 2015, George has passed away. Eric has happily moved on. I'm solid. Like, I've rediscovered myself. God, what a journey, right? I've gone from being a muse to being a fully actual self-realized person.
Can I ask you a question?
Of course.
So did J-Pop say that? So I know in the U.S., in many instances, a divorce decree will include that the lesser moneyed spouse, the wife usually, will receive alimony, support, maintenance, whatever, until such time as exactly. She remarries. Is that what was going on?
I think J-Pop was supposing that.
Okay.
I had not read the book.
Which is not, I mean... I'm with you, you know, if I'm Layla, then yes, Eric Clapton can continue delivering royalties unto me until...
Ride that monkey till you kill it,
yeah,
right?
Like, yeah, I mean, I'm sure that was not her... I would be very hesitant to remarry
after those two experiences. What you have set up in a structure, because Patty, bless her, when George is like, hey, quit your day job,
sure,
she really gets interested in photography. So she begins sort of as an amateur photographer, taking pictures of all these rare inside glimpses of the Beatles and their life and all the people they hang out with and all the things they do. So she is a professional photographer now. She did an amazing show of all these pictures that did an exhibition in a few years ago. She did publish a book co-authored with Penny Jr. called Wonderful Tonight. Patty was... bereft when George Harrison died. When she speaks of him, it is full of all of the tenderness.
Mm-hmm.
And Patty and sober Eric are friends. They've remained friends. She thinks Layla is masterful and still loves hearing it. And that is the trashy love triangle of George Harrison, Patty Boyd, and Eric Clapton.
Wow. Wow. I don't know what to say about that Eric Clapton fellow. Good song, but like that sounds bad.
Yeah, their marriage, like, it was pretty tumultuous.
Yeah.
And a lot of it was hidden from, I mean, he got help. Like, I think that was probably his point of, like, hold up, I need to make some different decisions.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it's actually fishing related. He talks about what that moment was when he got sober, and he said he was fishing, which is one of his favorite things to do, and he's chilling, and there are these two old guys across the river who are super big pros. And he's fishing all day and I guess drinking all day and ends up stumbling and breaking a rod and drives home and calls his buddy. And he's like, I'm done. Like, this is, I don't know what I'm doing. Like, all of this feels awkward and bad, but I am done feeling, I guess, like the embarrassed. Like,
yeah.
Yeah. So it's my 30 hours of research in a 35 minute story.
There you go. All right. Trash cans. Did you throw in a number?
I mean, it doesn't.
They all stayed friends.
They all I thought it was going to be a little trashier than that, but what a great story.
It's a great story.
Not very many. I mean, you know, everybody's got their problems. Like,
right.
There was some modicum of trashy behavior.
Sure.
Emotional affair, emotionally distant. Domestic violence is pretty bad.
Right, right.
I'm going to go let one more trash can for... No, I'm
sorry. We should probably assign them.
One and a half more trash cans for Patty and Eric than George and Patty. So what do you think the base level should be?
It sounds like with George and Patty, like, really, they sort of just grew apart. How long were they married?
66. They got divorced in 77. So
11 years. And wow, did they have a strange... life to get right, like
one and a half,
sure,
and then three.
So three
for Clapton Boyd.
Yeah,
there you go.
Cool.
And therein is the first trashiest trashy love triangle for trashy divorces. I don't know if we've really had a love triangle yet that we've covered.
Henry VIII.
Well, that was a love quadrangle.
He had the court of two queens and then the court of three queens.
That's
or whatever.
True.
So there were some triangles. There were some shapes.
There you go. It all comes back around again.
Cool. All right. Well, we're going to take a break. Have a little mid-roll.
I'm going to take off my glasses and get ready for your story.
Awesome.
I'm excited.
Gonna, woo. Yeah. All right. We'll be right back.
Hi, everyone. I'm Katie Nelson. And I'm Olivia Mickle. We're two academic sisters. And we host a podcast called What's Her Name? What's Her Name podcast tells you the stories of fascinating women that you've never heard of. We're unearthing the histories of really interesting women that have slipped through the cracks of our collective history. We add era-appropriate music. We interview really fascinating experts, everyone from professors to authors to the manager of a brothel museum. We cover it all. So give it a listen. What'sHerNamePodcast.com.
Let's do this.
Yeah, yeah.
I've been excited about your divorce all week.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I hope it lives up to your excitement, because this situation actually was so much worse than I realized. And I feel like I should put a content warning in for our listeners that there is substantial domestic violence in the marriage of Ike and Tina Turner.
Okay.
Much more than I realized. Like,
oh, wow.
Upsettingly so. That said, it starts cool. Like, the story starts cool.
Okay, talk to me.
So, if we're going to talk about the trashy divorces of musical royalty, we need to pull that camera back across the pond and dig right into the roots of modern American music, like rock and roll and rhythm and blues, okay?
Rock and roll, rhythm and blues.
And Ike Turner, like, was at the birth of rock and roll.
Tell me.
For real. So, he was born in 1931 in Clarksdale, Mississippi. It's a tiny town with an extraordinary blues pedigree. Muddy Waters was born nearby.
What?
On a cotton plantation and lived in Clarksdale until 1943 when he was like, fuck this.
Out of here.
And went to Chicago.
Yeah.
To be a full-time musician.
Wow.
When he was a young man, he'd watch blues legend Robert Johnson of, you know, Crossroads, Robert Johnson.
Muddy Waters.
Yeah. Play in
wow.
town. Maybe he played with him. I don't know. Because
wow.
there was... overlapping.
Wow.
It's possible. Bessie Smith died in Clarksdale, Mississippi after a car accident.
Really?
And Sam Cooke was born there. Like,
oh, wow.
It is a tiny town. Like, this is around 1930. I looked it up. There were like 10,000 people.
Mississippi has a legendary
rhythm
and blues musical legacy that comes out of
And the creatives, I mean, anyway, I will not talk about Faulkner. Ike Turner started playing guitar and piano. Ike Turner started playing guitar and piano when he was 8 years old.
Wow.
And he formed his first band in high school.
Okay.
He also had his first experience with a band breaking up in high school.
Oh.
When several of the Top Hatters, that
the
was the band.
The Top Hatters, I love
left
it.
To form the Dukes of Swing.
Oh, Jesus.
Ike would not be outdone. So the remaining members reformed, and he named them the Kings of Rhythm. Oh.
I got you.
God, I know, right? Like,
that's awesome.
Well, and that name stuck. Like, he was using that name for his band into the 2000s, even. So
I'm going to hold on to it. It's a good idea. Yeah. I had that good idea that one time.
Kings of Rhythm. Yeah. So when Ike was 20, the band heads up to Memphis to record at Sam Phillips' Sun Studio, which was brand new.
Wow.
Brand fucking new.
What year?
1951, I think.
Okay. Wow.
When Ike was 20. Yeah. So they record the song called Rocket 88, which is about like the latest model Oldsmobile that was out there. And this is certainly one of the first rock and roll songs ever recorded. And many people, including Sam Phillips, think it is the first. Like, it just has all of the elements that make a rock and roll song.
No way. 51.
Yep. Also, visit our website, trashydivorces.com, because we are going to plaster the entry for this episode with so many YouTube clips to cool music. This era, the 50s, 60s, like,
we have been a veritable Pandora sound station this week.
Super fun. Okay. The song was not released as a Kings of Rhythm song. It was, and I'm not sure why this was, but it was released under the name Jackie Brenston and the Delta Cats.
The Delta Cat sounds like a cool fucking band.
And I guess Jackie Brenston, I mean, he was in the Kings of Rhythm, and he sang the song.
Okay.
The song went to number one on the R&B charts. Like, imagine you're a 20-year-old guy from super rural Mississippi, and suddenly you've got a number one song. It's 1951. I mean,
hey,
there are
Beatles. Yeah, right? Crazy.
Just crazy. So Jackie Brenston quits the group.
What?
He's out of there.
The group that's named after him?
Well, the Kings of Rhythm.
See ya, losers.
I guess he's like, well, I got a number one song. I'm out of here.
Shit.
I don't know why it got.
Okay.
That may just have seemed more. It was probably a marketing thing. But anyway, he's out of there. So Ike starts commuting. It's like an hour and a half from Clarksdale to Memphis. He starts commuting there, working as a session musician.
Sure.
And a production assistant in Sam Phillips' studio. Like,
wow.
He okay. Also, he gets picked up to work as a talent scout for Modern Records, which is based in Los Angeles. But they realize there's a lot of Southern talent that
there's
want.
There's a scene happening.
They want scouted.
It
so,
happens in the 80s. Mm-hmm. There's a scene happening.
So during these years, Ike recorded with B.B. King, Little Junior Parker. He discovered talents like Bobby Bland and Howlin' Wolf.
Whoa.
Like,
whoa.
And again, this guy's, you know, in his early 20s. He is just, it must have just been an amazing time. He met Elvis before Elvis was Elvis. And years later, Elvis runs into him at a thing. And it's like, hey, do you remember me? I used to drive a truck in Memphis when you were working at the, at Sun. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yes.
So I do have a quick question.
Okay.
Is he a shitbag yet?
Yes. He does seem to be a shitbag at this point.
Okay, great.
I would have trouble explaining it, but basically his contractual agreements to Sun Studio and Modern Records or whatever, the record company, occasionally interfered with each other. And so he did some shady stuff.
Ooh.
Like he would send recordings that were supposed to go to one record label to Modern, like, things like that. Like, yeah, he was a little shady.
There's a little shady.
But it seems more, I think at this point it was more just he had good hustle.
Okay.
Right? Like he was
H-U-S-T-L-A-R hustle. Okay.
You know, he was making the world better. He was changing everything.
Let's
do it. I don't know.
Okay.
All right, 1956. So he's, what, 25 now? He is itching to get the band back together. And, oh my God, that's a real thing in this case. Okay. So he rounds up his buddies, and they move to St. Louis.
Jackie Brunson?
Not yet, but he does okay. come back. Actually, yeah, no, he does. He does come back. They reform.
Jackie, man, I missed you.
They reform the Kings of Rhythm. They move to St. Sweet. Louis. They rent a big house, probably rent a big house. They're all living in this big house together so they can rehearse all day long and play all night long.
Music is my life.
And it seems like this would be super awesome, except, as noted, Ike Turner's a little bit of a shitbag.
Oh, no.
So, on the plus side, he had a really strict rule about drinking and drugs in the house, which was, you don't do that. And he would fire people who okay. he caught drinking and drugging. So, like, that seems very smart and probably helped the longevity of the band and of whatever, of the musicians in the band. So, like, A plus there. On the minus side, he was known to do things like physically attack people who played the wrong note.
What?
Yeah. Like, he was domineering, hard charging. He was a band leader. You know, there was a horn section.
I'm sorry, all I could think about is a scene in the Goonies where I'm like, if you don't hit the right note, we're all gonna be flat. I'm sorry. I went into a different
different place. Okay.
No, he'd so, really beat you up if you played the wrong note?
I don't know if he'd beat you up, but maybe he would hit you.
Wow.
Not cool. And again, this is like, it's a big band. It's not like a four-piece, like, it's not like a rock band today. It's like, they had horns, they had, like, electric guitar, they had piano, they had, because I guess they didn't have keyboards at the time, they had, you know, it was a big thing. It was a big production.
So it sounds like maybe you have a volatile temper already.
Yes.
Maybe you're good to keep liquor and drugs out of the house.
See? That's
smart.
Again,
move.
Yeah, I'm fully agreeing
safety
with that.
First.
Also, this like tight discipline, it really paid off, and they became the most popular band.
Kings of Rhythm, yo.
In St. Louis, their biggest competition, I forget the name of the band, but it was Chuck Berry's band.
What?
Was their biggest competition.
Oh my God.
Yeah, like they were a big deal, and they'd had this number one hit record that everyone knew was them, that Rocket 88 had been them. And they were no longer in the South, which meant they could play in clubs that white people hung out at. So suddenly, like, they are playing all the time.
Better clubs, bigger clubs, getting some exposure.
Mm-hmm. All the time. St. Louis, East St. Louis, like,
world that is radically breaking down its racial barriers.
Yeah.
Funny that it's 70 years later. Go ahead.
All right. In 1957, the course of musical history changed when a 17-year-old named Anna Mae Bullock joined her sister at St. Louis's Club Manhattan to see Ike Turner and the Kings of Rhythm.
What?
Anna Mae, better known later in her life as Tina Turner,
simply the best,
later wrote, Ike Turner and the Kings of Rhythm were what was happening.
Wow.
In St. Louis, they were as big as the Beatles would be later on. She said that the first time she saw the band, the performance put her in a trance. So I think this sort of turned into, her sister worked at the club.
Okay.
So I think it kind of turned into a hangout.
Ooh, sure.
Some of what I read made it seem like the first night she saw them, she got her hand on a microphone and really impressed Ike with like just a fierce delivery. Others sort of made it seem like over time, this happened. She got to know band members. I think her sister dated the drummer or something. Like,
okay.
So anyway, but it seems like it didn't take a long time for
Ike to be exposed to Anna Mae's talent.
Right. So once he did hear her sing, he was like, wow, you're really good. Would you like to be in my band? And so they talked to her, like they convinced her parents to let her join the band.
Wow.
He gave her the stage name Little Ann. She was very skinny.
Okay.
I don't know why Ike Turner was constantly giving people names. Like, I don't know if he did this with other people or if it was just her. But anyway, so she got a new name. It's
J-pop.
like joining a cult.
I have nicknames for everybody. Some people, I get it from my granddad. Maybe it's DNA. I don't know.
No,
doesn't
but
matter.
I mean, the
Not
stage
important.
Name thing. Because twice in her life, he gives her a stage name.
Kings of Rhythm.
Okay.
I got that great idea that one time.
So Little Ann dated the band saxophonist for a while and actually had a child with him. But by 1959, the saxophonist broke his ankle and the injury was bad enough that he had to go home to Mississippi and never came back.
Oh.
Anyway, so by 59, she and Ike were romantically involved. In her 2018 memoir, My Love Story, Tina Turner says that it just kind of happened by accident. Like, they were just, like...
around each other all the time?
And... yeah, just hanging out one night and kind of crossed the line. And it was just kind of easier to, like, remain lovers rather than try to, like, put their friendship back in place.
Sure.
So they did.
Okay.
In early 1960, Ike had booked studio time to record a song he'd written called A Fool in Love. The singer who was slated to sing it did not show up, and so he let Little Ann do the vocals, and it went pretty well. And he sends it to a disc jockey.
Oh, I love this story.
In St. Louis, and the DJ is like, holy shit, and he sends it to Juggy Murray,
okay,
who ran an R&B label in New York called Sue Records. Juggy is like on the phone to Ike as soon as he hears this, and like, listen up.
Dude.
Little Ann, that's your star. You need to quit wasting your time with this other guy that you were going to have sing this. No.
That's the voice.
I would like to give you either $20,000 or $25,000. I saw both numbers. To buy the rights to your song with her singing it.
That's a nice phone call to get.
Yeah. So, like, get your head out of your ass, Ike Turner. Like,
that's your moneymaker.
Yes. So let's go back to Ike's experiences with the Top Hatters breaking up and splintering off into two bands, and Jackie Brenston leaving after the success of Rocket 88. Although, so he had come back to the band.
Okay.
But Ike would never let him sing Rocket 88 live, ever. He was barred from that.
What?
It was crazy. Ike Turner was just a jerk. They play the song, they just don't let the guy who sang it on the record sing it.
What?
Yeah, he's being punished.
Oh, Jesus.
Okay. So he's had all these experiences.
He's a shitbag.
Ike has. So he decides that because in his life history, when people get successful, they leave him. Or if they think they can get successful, they leave him. What he's going to do is create a character that any woman can sort of just roll into. So he'll start it with Little Ann. But he's sure she's going to leave. So he was a fan of a TV show that was on at some point called Sheena, Queen of the Jungle. And he decides that Tina, which rhymes with Sheena, super cool, and Tina Turner has a nice alliteration. So the Ike and Tina Turner Review was born.
That's for real?
That's for real.
Oh, my God.
That is for real.
Oh, my God.
And not only is it for real, but... that song that she recorded, A Fool in Love, became a smash hit. And then, like, this band became famous, and then it became mega famous. Like, in the 60s and 70s, the Ike and Tina Turner Review was boom. So, A Fool in Love sold a million copies.
Wowza. I did notice your attention, because I just grabbed my phone, because I'm listening to this story. And I know you're going to laugh at me.
What's going on?
The lurking feeling of...
what's happening?
This fucking asshole's a Scorpio. This guy's a Scorpio. This guy is a Scorpio. His birthday, Ike Turner, November the 5th. He's a Scorpio.
Okay. I did just roll my eyes if we don't cut this. Okay, so A Fool in Love sold a million copies. And it was followed by other singles that charted, including It's Gonna Work Out Fine and I Idolize You. They had this like wild, high energy show style. It just entranced audiences, ultimately like worldwide on television. I mean,
they're a big deal.
They were a big deal. So Ike and Tina married in Tijuana in 1962. And, you know, they're 62. Their careers were just exploding. The Review was just a big band with horns, electric guitars. There were female dancers, the Ikettes. So they were like dancers and backup singers for Tina.
This is a production.
It's huge. It's like, it's super cool. Again, like check out, we'll have so many videos on the website, and it's so much fun to watch because it's not scripted the way like a Lady Gaga or I don't know, like there are a lot of artists today who have these big dance-filled productions, sure. But they're so scripted. It looks so loose. I'm sure this is Ike Turner's band. They were rehearsed.
They were not loose.
They were not loose, but it looked loose. Huh. I mean, it is incredible. The energy here is wild. So super fun. It took off. So they had hits like Poor Fool, River Deep, Mountain High. That one did way better in Europe than in the U.S.
Super good song.
All right. Then monster classics like when they covered Creedence Clearwater Revival's Proud Mary. Holy shit. In 1966 and in 1969, Mick Jagger invited them to open for the Rolling Stones, which boosted them even higher, particularly in the UK.
I didn't know that. Wow.
So Ike and Tina relocated to Los Angeles, lived in a mansion in Inglewood. They built a state-of-the-art recording studio next door that was used by artists like Paul McCartney, George Harrison, Dwayne Allman, Little Richard, Frank Zappa. I mean,
holy smokes.
It's an amazing story, except...
Oh, no.
Except that shitbag Ike Turner.
A listener, pour yourself a drink.
Yeah, this is really content warning for real. Was just a super masochistic domestic abuser, like par excellence. In fact, according to Tina Turner, the first time Ike ever hit her was back in 1960 when he was like...
2 years before they got married?
When he was like, by the way, your stage name now is Tina Turner. She was like, I don't want to be Tina Turner. My name is Anne. And he grabbed a shoe... a wooden shoe thing.
My granddad had those.
Yeah, hit her in the head with it. Yeah. So she became Tina Turner. And then she became Anne Turner, I guess. Anime Turner. In that 2018 memoir, which is her second memoir, Tina, this is so horrible. Tina says of their Tijuana wedding, "Our wedding, he decided, would take place in Tijuana, Mexico, because they weren't fussy about little things like having a marriage license. There was no point objecting. That would just make him mad and might lead to a beating. I definitely didn't want a black eye on my wedding day." Then, because Ike Turner is a shitbag, on their wedding night, he took her to a live sex show in Tijuana.
What?
Yeah. He took her a brothel or some, a place where live sex shows happen. And she said, "I was miserable, on the verge of tears, but there was no escape. We couldn't leave until Ike was ready, and he was having a fine old time. The experience was so disturbing that I just scratched it out. By the time we got back to Los Angeles, I'd created a completely different scenario in my head. A romantic elopement. The following day, I was bragging to people, 'Guess what? Oh, Ike took me to Tijuana. We got married yesterday.'" Which, there's so much in here that is just like classic victim.
No, if you...
This is how you survive this type of abuse.
That's how you survive with an abuser.
She said that she felt like the bruises he left on her body throughout the marriage. They were married until 76.
Wow.
Okay, so she said she felt like the bruises he left on her body were marks of ownership. By 1968, Ike had moved two other women into their home and was having affairs with both.
Excuse me?
Even better... Those two women were also named Anne, so Ike never had to learn a new name.
Oh my God.
And couldn't screw it up. And one of them became his wife after Tina Turner broke up.
Were Anne. He just, like, I'm only interested in Anne's.
I think for one it was a middle name, but I think she went by.
Jesus Christ.
Not like Ike is super committed to people's real names anyway.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'm back. There's a lot to process there.
Sure.
She's
Tina Turner.
Married to Ike and she's got two other sister wives?
Basically.
Nobody.
Yeah. Shockingly, you'll be amazed to learn that Tina Turner attempted suicide around this time. She took 50 Valium.
Mm.
Was trying to time it so that this is, and again, this is so...
Anything to get me out of this.
But she tried
There's no other alternative.
She tried to time it so the pills would kick in at a point in the show that would make sure that Ike still got paid. Like, again, this is so, like, abused.
You are.
The pills kicked in early. She was rushed to the hospital. They saved her life, obviously. And when she woke up, Ike was there and said, "You should die, motherfucker." So, and then she was discharged a couple days later, and Ike had her back on stage that night. He is a shitbag. Similarly, when she gave birth to their child, I think he let her have 2 days off before being back on stage. Yeah. He was controlling of the creative process. He managed like how she sang the songs, and she was not allowed to deviate from his commands about that. How the dancers danced, all of it. It was all Ike controlled everything. He's super controlling.
I mean, you can imagine being an abused spouse and that's your home life.
Yeah.
But your spouse goes to work, so you can almost get a break from it, but
yeah, these two
you work with your
had a like, you career
don't
together.
Get
yeah.
a break from it. You're in that is 24-hour assault.
So that second time that they opened for the Rolling Stones in 1969, during that tour, Tina just felt sicker and sicker and sicker and ultimately like couldn't perform. They go to the doctor. She's got tuberculosis.
What?
Had to be hospitalized, and the Stones sent flowers, but Ike was just pissed at her for having to cancel tour dates. That was it. Okay. It was also during this period that Ike, who, as you may recall, had been pretty hardcore on the sobriety thing once upon a time, discovered the joys of a little drug called cocaine.
Cocaine.
Now, I think it's fairly well understood that cocaine is not a personality-improving substance. And Tina says that eventually Ike was just staying awake for like 5 days at a time.
No,
and then
no,
he would come
no,
back and
no.
like sleep it off for a few days and then just wake up and do it all over. I'm sure he was fully rational and in control of his emotions and not at all completely crazy.
So Scorpios are known for their... No, it's bad.
Yeah, coked up. He once threw hot coffee in her face and gave her third-degree burns. He broke her jaw. And she says that at any given time, one or the other of her eyes was always black.
Oh, my God.
She went to the ER all the time, but she thinks that at the like in the 70s, doctors just assumed, like, oh, it's just black people. So Ike referred to her openly, I guess, as my $1 million. And
this is a horrible story.
That's what I'm telling you. It was so much worse than I realized. We are nearly to the good parts.
I need a good part.
One more dip into the bad part. By 1974, Ike had burned a hole through his septum in his nose from snorting coke. And the condition was so painful that there was only one thing that would help it, which was more cocaine.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
I don't mean to laugh because addiction is awful and all that, but whoa. In July 1976.
I need some sunshine.
it's coming. July 1976. It is the bicentennial of the United States. The review, the Ike and Tina Turner review, is booked in Dallas for a week of shows celebrating. Similar to what will happen this July and every July in America.
It's a big America
it's
day.
It's a big America day.
Bicentennial's big damn day.
Bicentennial is. This is actually my birth year, if you guys want to do that math. Ike and Tina get into a fight in the car way to the hotel.
Okay.
And he just ends up punching her. Uh-oh. Over and over and over and over and over again. And by
before
the time
the
they,
show? Great.
I think they probably weren't performing that. I'm not sure about the time on this. I think they weren't performing that night. I think they arrived and were going to perform the next night. By the time they get to the hotel, though, she was wearing white and her clothes were covered in blood.
Oh, my God.
Ike told the hotel staff that they'd had an accident on the way over to cover it. And again, it's just like nobody...
You are a serial abuser and you need to be locked up.
Agreed.
You need to be locked up.
And she, of course, has taught herself how to
live with a serial abuser.
Right. So they get into the hotel room and she plays the role of forgiving wife. Like, I know, like, shouldn't have said that. You know what? Let me rub
your... Is your victim, it's up to me to fucking comfort you. God damn it, this makes me mad.
Rub your temples. Let's get you a nap. Because he was recovering from another cocaine binge, too.
Oh, so. God.
So, Ike Turner falls asleep. Tina grabs a toiletries case and runs.
Gets the fuck out. I've done that in a relationship. I had a key in a pocket and a knife to my throat at the driveway at 4 a.m. And I got in my car and I drove away and I never looked back.
Yeah.
It's what you do.
Yeah. She ran across an interstate in Dallas, Texas, Jesus in the dark Christ. On foot.
Oh, my God.
She she filed for divorce on July 27, 1976, citing irreconcilable differences. She was not, she had not talked about the abuse yet, even though everyone in her life must have seen it.
How can you not see it?
Yeah. Plus, there were two other Anns living, you know, I don't know if he was beating them too, but he was understandably resistant to let her go, she being his meal ticket. So for over a year, they squabbled about money and property in court. And in late 77, Tina was like, you know what? I want nothing.
Fuck it. I'm out.
So she wrote a settlement that gave him that recording studio, their publishing companies, the mansion in Inglewood.
Oh, my God.
Four cars. Like, in total, it was like a $500,000 settlement in 1977 dollars.
Wow.
All that she took from the marriage, and this is completely ironic, is the stage name Tina Turner.
And her toiletries case.
But, like, you know, the first time this bastard hit her is because she didn't want the name.
And that's what she...
It's all she got.
What?
But, I mean, it... Like, she needed it at that point for further lucrative. In 85, after Tina had...
Here comes the sun.
Right.
Come on.
In 85, after Tina had gone public with about the abuse... Ike told a reporter, yeah, I hit her, but I didn't hit her more than the average guy beats his wife. Which,
what?
I know, like, okay. So, a little bit about how Ike's life went. His later career was extremely hampered in the aftermath of the divorce, probably largely because of the massive cocaine habit that swamped his life until he finally got clean in 1991.
Mm.
Throughout the 80s, he had kind of constant run-ins with the law, mostly with about drugs and firearms. That's a great combo.
Good combo. Bonus.
He served 18 months in a California prison between 1990 and 91.
For those related
cocaine
things.
Cocaine and
perfect.
Guns. Cocaine and guns. he got clean in 91.
Yay you.
He gradually returned to performing. And he released a Grammy-nominated album in 2001. And he won his first solo Grammy in 2007 for the album Risin' with the Blues. And he died on December 12th of that year of a cocaine overdose.
No!
Because he had relapsed in 04. Over the course of his life, he was married at least 8 times.
What?
It could be 13. No one knows.
Jesus Christ, what?
His first marriage was when he was in high school, I think, and they split up almost.
She really liked the Kings of Rhythm. Oh, my God.
But, I mean, it was that would have been the 40s in rural Mississippi. Like, I don't.
Just keep on getting married. It's fine.
Yeah.
It's fine.
And honestly, I think he was married when he and Tina first started seeing each other.
What?
Like, I think she was pregnant with his child when he was still married to someone else. Like, once he was divorced from Tina, he married one of the other aunts. Like, and she wasn't his last wife. There was at least one more after that. Okay, so at least 8 wives over the course of his life, had at least 7 children, like 7 that are known about, but it's...
Oh my God.
This guy clearly had a lot going on.
H-U-S-T-L-A-R,
so,
Hustler.
So there could be a lot of little Turners. Well, I mean, now they're probably not that little, but
sure,
could be a lot more Ike Juniors and
wow,
Ike Hess Juniors. Now let's talk about the further adventures of Anna Bullock.
Yes, let's please do, because Tina Turner's a fucking badass.
I'm going to try not to cry, because this is so awesome. Tina Turner returned to the stage in 77 with a series of shows in Vegas.
Yeah!
And made appearances on television shows like Hollywood Squares and Sonny and Cher. And just doing stuff. It was not easy. It started very small venue.
She's got nothing. I have a toiletries case in my fucking name.
And
that
he controlled all the money. Like, when she got across that interstate to a hotel,
what could she do?
She had 36 cents in her pocket.
Oh my God.
And no, I mean, at that point, like, federally, women had only been granted the right to have credit cards in their own names in 74. He legitimately controlled all of their finances, and that was fine at the time. No one would have thought that was strange at all. But she was the draw. Like, she was the earner. Anyway, but she, again, was the draw, was the earner, is an amazing performer. So she was a successful touring artist.
I can build this back up.
Even without any big albums that, you know, were... So there were two records that came out over the next couple of years that finished out her contractual obligations to her old labels.
Okay.
Fast forward to June. 1984. And she's been working and touring and, like, you know, this whole time. But, like, June 1984. Capitol Records released the album Private Dancer.
Yeah, they did.
Yeah, they did. Included the singles What's Love Got to Do With It, Better Be Good to Me, Private Dancer, and Let's Stay Together. It has sold more than 20 million copies around the world.
What?
It won 4 Grammy Awards
in
85. It was supported by a 177-date world tour, and the massive success of the record cemented Tina Turner as a bona fide icon.
No, that was my 8th grade freshman year in high school.
Oh my gosh, this is the music of my childhood.
Anywhere. Yeah. Without it.
And she's such a badass. The following year, I being a fan of sci-fi and dystopian stuff, she acted opposite Mel Gibson in Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome. This became a global hit. Still is. Holds up.
Yeah.
She contributed 2 songs to the soundtrack, and I can recall playing the hell out of We Don't Need Another Hero when I was a kid. She has a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame.
Oh, my God.
And for about a decade, she held the Guinness World Record for, quote, largest paying rock concert attendance for a solo artist when she performed for 180,000 people.
What?
In a stadium in Rio de Janeiro in 1988.
Wow.
I didn't know they built structures that could hold that many people. So in 91, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame was like,
yeah.
Hey! Ike and Tina Turner were really important in rock history.
Oh, no.
We're going to induct them.
Oh.
Neither of them attended.
What?
Well, Ike was in prison in California.
Can't make it.
Tina had relocated to Europe. And I don't know. Like, I'm not sure if that's just she just prefers Europe to the States. Or if she just cannot be far enough away from Ike Turner.
I get both. And I get, you know what? Thanks, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. That's a really big deal.
Yeah.
But I'd rather not be recognized with my husband.
That's...
With my ex-husband.
Beat the hell out of... Why on earth?
Thank you. You can go ahead and recognize me on my own for my own talents.
That too. In 93, the semi-autobiographical movie What's Love Got to Do With It was released, earning Angela Bassett and Lawrence Fishburne Best Actress and Best Actor nominations at the Oscars. She was recognized by the Kennedy Center Honors in 05, performed along Beyoncé at the 08 Grammy Awards, and after fans of an English soccer club started an online campaign to get her 1989 hit The Best back onto the UK charts in 2010. It's like the team's anthem.
Sure.
Okay, this is the craziest thing. She became the only female recording artist to ever have top 40 hits in 6 consecutive decades in the UK.
What?
It is some Scottish soccer club.
Football. That is 6 decades?
6 decades.
Jesus, Peter and Paul.
Yep. She appeared on the cover of German Vogue in 2013 at the age of 73.
She is such a badass.
Becoming the oldest person ever to grace a Vogue cover.
Wow.
Same year, she became a Swiss citizen and relinquished her American citizenship.
Really?
Today, she is 78 years old. She has spent 34 years in a relationship with a German music executive named Erwin Bach.
Oh my gosh.
And the couple married in 2013 and live in Switzerland.
What?
Yeah.
Wow. I love this story. I mean, I don't.
I am crying. I'm doing a really good job of modulating my voice, but I am crying because it is so good.
The first 60% of that story was total shit, but last part of it was amazing.
Five trash cans.
Oh, you're doing great, Buns. You're doing great.
And that...
Wow.
...is Ike and Tina.
That's an amazing story. I knew I loved Tina Turner. I didn't know I loved her like that. I love you like that, boo.
Simply the best.
She fills me with fucking delight.
She's awesome.
When it comes to national treasures, Dolly Parton, Tina Turner, boom. Thanks, y'all. Thanks. We'll never cover Dolly Parton. Like, she doesn't have a trashy divorce, but Tina Turner, you're our trashy divorces heroine.
Dude, so much. She's great.
She's a survivor.
Yeah. Yeah.
She's a total survivor.
Yeah. Well, I need to take a break before we come back and record the intro.
You're doing great.
Thanks.
Hey, y'all. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Trashy Divorces. As a cautionary measure, if you're in that kind of situation, find some help.
You can email us.
Protect yourself. Find some help.
See how we can help you.
Yeah, it's not acceptable. And Tina Turner, survivor, it can be done. There is hope. There is a life beyond what that feels like. Oh, yep. Fuck. Now I'm going to cry.
Yep. All right.
God damn. All right.
All right. Hey, that's so funny. We've decided that maybe our sign out is keep it trashy. This seems not like the right time.
Keep it trashy, not like Ike.
Oh.
Wow. What a... Tina Turner, you're simply the best. Patty Boyd, psh, kick ass girl. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Trashy Divorces.
We will see you next week.
We're going to go find a box of Kleenex now.
No kidding.
And cheers at you. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks.
Trashy Divorces is a Hemlock Creatives production.
Our music is by Ratsy.
You can find her on Instagram at Ratsy's Store.
Our art is by Sydney V. Smith.
You can find her art at sydneyvsmith.carbonmade.com.
We are on all kinds of social media.
At Trashy Divorces, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter.
We're on Patreon.
Holy cats, are we on Patreon?
We sure are.
Find some super fun bonus content there.
Totally.
Tell a friend about Trashy Divorces.
Like, rate, review.
And if you have communication for us or are desperate to tell us your near and dear trashy divorce, send us email to
trashydivorces@gmail.com.
Man, that's the outro business.
We've made it pretty easy.
Keep it classy, friends.
Don't take trash candy from strangers.